Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, the 20th of August, 1999. We are in the Creekside Room of Koinonia this morning. Your presenter's name is Lisa Kildegard. Today's session number is 99-8. Lisa continues her series, O Taste and See, Contemporary Poetry, with the theme, The Healing of the Nations, this morning. Let's listen in.
Myself to those of you slackers who haven't shown up in my class before. I'm actually thrilled to see you. I have been enjoying these classes very much. We've had a really good time this time off. It matters to me. My name is Lisa Kildegard. I teach at Luther College in the English department, which is a very fun job. But I keep reminding myself as I'm about to run back home and start it up again. And the question that I've been hearing this week in particular is, well, where did you find these poems? Where did you get them from? And I was kind of surprised by this because, of course, there's a lot of poems out there, and I kind of expected the question to be more, why didn't you find these other poems that are really good, which is sort of an associated question. I am always interested in new good poems. So if you have an author that you, poets are not, you know, they don't make CNN. They are not headline news. They are not reported on very much. And so it can be difficult to find the name of a poet that you end up really, really enjoying. So if you have such a name, please share it with me. But I will tell you where I have found some of my poetry that I have brought for these sessions. One really good set that I just found this summer is the National Poetry Archive, which is on the web, and you know, a really intelligent person would have brought the whole web address. But you can just do a search for Poetry Archive on the web, and you will find some of our premier contemporary poets with poems posted daily. The Billy Collins poem that we read last week came from there. The McKeel McBride poem about juggling, if you're picking up extra copies, came from there. It's a wonderful site with really excellent stuff on it. And it's easy to navigate. And I think really the best way to learn which poets you might enjoy reading more deeply or more thoroughly, a really good way is just through random accident, right? Just by happening upon a voice that you really appreciate, really says something to you, and then exploring a little bit more of those, of the poems from that particular poet. So just learning a few names of people whose work you might like to read more of. And this, I can tell you, can be a many-year journey, right? You can read a poem and begin to build slowly. There's maybe it's just my personality, but I really believe in the sort of long accretion of poems in your life. So try and bump into someone on the web. Now, how many of you have internet access? That's something that you have not used. You already know that you find a lot of interesting, weird stuff on the web, and it takes some sifting, but there is some extremely high-quality work out there to look at. So find a site that you like and check in on it. The National Poetry Archive puts up, I don't know, I think it might be a poem a day, it might be one a week, but they're extraordinarily wonderful, wonderful things. Don't try to go too fast. Don't decide you're going to now learn about contemporary poetry in the next week or two. At least I wouldn't be able to do this. I had a beloved spinster aunt who lived in New York City in Manhattan. She was like Miss Manhattan. And she worked in her glamorous job as a statistician for a research foundation where she smoked a lot of cigarettes and went out for lunches and joined the Statistical Fellows Association, which then had to change where it met because only men were allowed. She was one of these people, you know, who knew opera singers and stuff. She worked a block from the Museum of Contemporary Art in New York City, Manhattan. And she used to go on her lunch break and look at a painting. And she often would talk to us, her little country mice, nieces and nephews, about how to look at a painting, which was one at a time. You know, those of us who get to go to museums only rarely tend to try and do the museum and see everything in the museum, and it becomes kind of a jumble. But she used to go and visit the Museum of Contemporary Art, look at a painting, and go back to work. And this always struck me as a good model for introducing yourself to works of art. Take your time, take it slow, and allow yourself to grow a relationship with the work of art. It's my infomercial for how to become more familiar with poetry, which turns out to be kind of a challenging thing to do. Poetry doesn't enter our lives with any kind of regularity. You know, you need to seek it out a little bit. Some good sources for poems are, there's some good anthologies out there. This is, I'll pass this one around. This is kind of the one college profs use the most for contemporary poetry. You should know that contemporary and modern mean rather different things for English profs. Modern is, you know, that bunch of guys and Virginia Woolf who were around the, you know, I thought wrote their pants off, but figuratively. she was a publisher of T.S. Eliot and some of the others. Modern is really World War II era, maybe into the 50s, maybe back into the 20s, but it's a maybe as early as the Armory Show in New York in, I think, 1911 or 1913. You know, there's different ways of identifying what modernity is, but it's older than a lot of what we've been reading. Contemporary poetry is more up to the minute what's being written lately. It can be as early as the 50s, but anything that's on the National Poetry Archive, I think they all do exclusively contemporary things, things that are written for them. So this is the contemporary anthology that many college profs use. You'll notice that they have actually put women into anthologies, which I have to tell you, I don't know how old I look, but this is something that I've seen in my own generation, right? In the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry that I grew up with in college, there just wasn't a whole lot of babe action, I will tell you that. And now they're sort of listening to women's voices. There's an Oxford anthology that I don't remember the exact title of. I'm thinking it's not the one that's called Postmodern. We won't go into what that is, but there is an Oxford anthology edited by S.J. Kennedy that's very good, very, very good work. I would have brought it with me, but the friend I had who has a copy moved to Decatur, so I let her book go with her. This is an anthology of poetry by the Norton Company, which puts out anthologies, very a little more scholarly. They are the famous onion skin paper anthologies. And this one has poems ranging back, way back to even, you know, Chaucer. So they've got some medieval, and then they end up with, it's done, what's that called, chronologically. And they have some, I think the last guy in here is Michael Ondaatje. Yes. So a poem written in 1973 is about as late-breaking as this gets, but there's been more recent editions than this. This is the library version. Go to a college bookstore or a good quality bookstore, even, you know, Barnes & Noble's going to have stuff like this, and thumb through a few anthologies and see which print face you like. And then take it home and crack it open and read a poem. Right? Don't like that one? There's always tomorrow. So an anthology is actually a really good way to go. But after you get used to an anthology, go this way. It's a funny thing, but I don't know if the rest of you have experienced this, but they never anthologize the works I especially love. It's the funniest thing, you know? The more you know about the poet, the more ticked off you are at what becomes the canonical works. And there's very good poetry in anthologies. I don't mean to diss them completely, but the more used to the anthology you get, the more used to the poets you get, the more you will see the limitations of that. And for that, the only real answer is to go to these very expensive but totally delightful volumes of a poet's work. This is for sale at the bookstore. It's the collected Wendell Berry. There's one copy, I think only it's $12. And I think I don't know how many poems for these sessions came out of this exact book. He is one of my absolute favorites. There's something about his voice really resonates for me. So I've been reading him since I was a teenager and have lots to go yet. At Matins the other day, Tom read from the Manifesto of the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. He read the ending of that poem. And I was flashing, I'm sitting in the big, weird stone auditorium at LSTC in Chicago and hearing one of the Berrigan brothers read that poem out loud. And I can't remember if it was Daniel or Philip. I think it must have been Philip, but I can't really remember. So that's, you know, you can build a long history. I still have lots of him to read. And I saw that in the bookstore there's a new book, Since Human Least Collected Works Only Stop in 1982. Lucille Clifton, I have a couple of her poems along. She's awfully good. She's an African-American woman on in years, and she writes poetry that's very sassy, very sharp, very powerful, and I think also very beautiful. It has a very, accessible, natural kind of voice, and yet there's a real power to it.
Did she write the poem that ends, "When I see you, I stand up, I stand up"? What's the one about the...
It'll come to you, it'll come.
Yeah, I think she wrote it. Wonderful.
I wonder.
Not Maya Angelou.
Maya Angelou?
It's a small woman. It's the one about when I see you, bulging, brown, brassy, blah, 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 I stand up. Okay.
When you find it, send it to me.
I'll look
at
it.
This is a pretty recent one, I think. Copper Canyon Press. You can see this book is $11. You know? And there's lots of room to take notes. It's $11, which is significant, but it's really poets, you know, none of them are exactly living the life of variety and ease. The ones I know are not exactly saying, ha 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 ha, my book $11. And all I did was gold jewel. Actually, that's what I did. She probably is laughing like that. Annie Dillard, how many of you are familiar with her? Very prolific, wonderful, interesting writer. I don't know these poems at all, but I wish I did. I was looking at this and thinking, I bet this is a Holden Village Tickets for a Prayer Wheel. I bet this is a winner too. How do you find books like this? You do what I just did, on whatever scale you can afford. You go wander in the bookstore, right? That center of human civilization and hopefulness, the bookstore. And pick something up and take a risk on it, and then be sure to take your time and not make your judgments too fast. Anyone else have sources for poetry that they use? Barbara and I were talking about the New Yorker will sometimes surprise you with something really terrific, and sometimes you just don't want to look at it. You're right in the middle of some long discussion of the Ebola virus or whatever, and you know, it's just, you don't really feel like looking at the refractions of light in Wisconsin. But they're very good poems in the New Yorker. Any other sources that any of the rest of you particularly want to share? Yeah.
Just going to a reading. And hearing and discovering someone who's really
wonderful. Yeah, that's amazing. I heard a woman in Albuquerque this summer who really, her voice was so animated and beautiful, and her poetry gained breath from it. It was really wonderful. I can't remember her name, Munoz, I think. Yeah, a reading at a bookstore, at a university, if that's accessible to you, it takes patience. You know, there you are. You're going to read.
Local bookstores will often have little self-published books of local people.
Yes. And poets often revert to this, right? There's Milkweed Editions in Minnesota, and there's the Les Hills Press in Iowa. There's lots of smaller presses that put out work. Some of it bad, you know, or some of it that just won't do anything for you at all. And I think part of loving poetry is accepting that some voices just don't speak to you and others do. Anything else? All right, today I want to say one more thing, which is I have my leftover sheets here of poems that we've read over the last 2 weeks. Some real winners on there. And if you would like to collect up copies, and to take home, please do help yourself. I'm not taking them back to Decorah, so help yourself for any sessions that you missed. Today's theme is the tragic theme in some ways, or I don't know, it's like the difficult theme of the healing of the nations. And you'll remember from our passage in Revelation that this is what the passage ends on. It's very, very interesting to me that that's sort of the end of the verse. That the tree of life doesn't really mean anything until the nations are healed. It's not a private vision. It's not a solitary vision. It's a vision about community and peace, finally. And I thought a lot about this metaphor of how leaves might heal nations. I personally didn't get very far with it, you know. And Jan today in Bible study was saying the aloe is a medicinal plant that heals. And that was helpful to me to think about. I have done some work in what's now called peace studies. I'm actually right now writing an article about Virginia Woolf's last essay, her last novel, and how she used Shakespeare's great anti-war play, Troilus and Cressida, in her last novel. She was profoundly, profoundly pacifist person, very interesting woman. And her ideas of what peace looks like have been very important to me. She, in the dark days of the emergence of World War II, which she was right at a place where what was happening in Europe was extremely visible to her. Her family and friends were all very much involved in the political scene. She was married to a Jew, and they were absolutely clear on what fascism meant to Jews. She and her husband at first stocked petrol and kept it in their garage in case the Germans should hop the channel and get to England. She was very clear about the what was happening in Europe. And she wrote a great essay called Three Guineas that I think has not been read sufficiently, Three Guineas, where she asks, how can a woman prevent war? Or really, how can we prevent war? And the question becomes, how can a woman prevent war? And in this essay, which I'm not going to go on for hours about, although I could because it's really fabulous, in this essay, she argues that fascism and patriarchy are cut out of the same cloth, that they mutually articulate each other, that you are not going to solve the problems in Europe until you look at what's happening in the private home. She argues that the public world, the theater of war, is connected to the way domestic life is carried on in Great Britain. Now, for how many of you does this seem like a really extraordinary idea? This seems kind of like, we sort of at this point in time say, yep, right, what's the great saying from the 60s feminist movement? The personal is political, right? We can say that how we live in our private lives might be connected to how our nation is conceived. Use that very private metaphor, right? That kind of makes sense to us. But back in 1937, 38, 39, when Virginia Woolf wrote Three Guineas, no one in her community of brilliant intellectuals and activists was able to think this way. And when she came out with her essay saying fascism and patriarchy, the injustices of the private life and the injustices of the public life are deeply, deeply interconnected. When she came out with that, her friends really, they went ballistic. They said, great, sure, whatever. We've got some big problems here in Europe right now. Could you be quiet about those women's rights things until we get this stuff settled, right? They felt the pressure of the war very powerfully. And I've been reading in her letters and reading in the London Times from 1939 this summer and seeing how what she had to say about women and war was completely incoherent when she said it. It was not something that even her very radical group of friends, her best friends, could understand and hear. And yet I think it's something very important to say about
about the world. I think it's important to see the interconnectedness of these types of destructive relationships. It's important to analyze thoroughly the private as well as the public. And I just have this very profound sense that the nations aren't going to be healed until we heal in a variety of ways. You know, that the peace accords are very important. It's very important work. But we're not going to get to certainly anything like the Revelation version of the healing of nations until we can heal the public and the private world together. So this is a preamble to the poem that I have brought today, which is this wonderful June Jordan poem, War and Memory, which takes the same sort of approach to, I think she writes really in the vein of Virginia Woolf. I think the two of them, you know, you'd love to stage a dinner party where the two of them could meet. June Jordan is an African-American poet, but I don't know how old she's gotten. She must be in her 60s anyway. She must be. She might be a little older. I think probably 60s. She is a lesbian woman. She is a marvelous poet, I think. Just marvelous and worthy of reading. She wrote another great poem about visiting the Vesterheim Norwegian Museum in Decorah, Iowa, which will really blow your mind. It's terrific. It's true. Here's her poem, War and Memory. So I'll sit down and read to you. Daddy at the stove or sink. Large knife nearby or artfully suspended by his clean hand, handsome even in its menace, slamming the silverware drawer open and shut, the spoons suddenly loud, as the yelling at my mother, no, she would say, no, Granville, no, about would he be late? Had she hidden away the Chinese laundry shirts again? Did she think it right that he, a man in his own house, should serve himself a cup of tea, a plate of food? Perhaps she thought that he should cook the cabbage and the pot roast for himself as well. It sure did seem she wanted him to lose his job because she could not find the keys. He could not find, and no, she would attempt to disagree. No, Granville, no. But was he trying to destroy her with his mouth? My mouth? My daddy hunkered down, incredulous and burly now with anger. What you mean, my mouth? You woman, who you talk to in that way? I am master of this castle. Here he gestured with the kitchen fork around the sagging clutter, laugh and choke the rage, tears watering his eyes. You no speak to me like that, you hear, you damn black woman? And my mother, backing up, or hunching smaller than frail bones should easily allow, began to munch on saltine crackers, let the flat crumbs scatter on her full lips and the oilcloth on the table. You answer me, he'd scream at last. I speak to you, you answer me. And she might struggle then to swallow or to mumble finally out loud, and who are you supposed to be? The Queen of England or the King? And he, berserk with fury, lift a chair or frying pan, and I'd attack in her defense. No, Daddy, no, rushing for his knees and begging, please don't, Daddy, please. He'd come down hard, my head break into daylight pain, or rip me spinning crookedly across the floor. I'd match him fast for madness, lineage in wild display, age 6. My pigtails long enough to hang me from the ceiling. I would race about for weaponry, another chair, a knife, a flowered glass, the radio. You stop it, Daddy, stop it! Brandishing my arsenal, my mother silently beside the point. He'd seize me, or he'd duck the glass. You devil child, you damn black devil child! And what are you supposed to be? My mother might inquire from the doorway. White? Are you supposed to be a white man, Granville? Not white, but right. And I would have to bite and kick or race away, sometimes out the house and racing still for blocks, my daddy chasing after me. Daddy at the table, reading all about the Fiji Islanders, or childhood in Brazil, his favorite National Geographic research into life beyond our neighborhood. My mother looking into the refrigerator. Mama, I cried after staring at the front page photo of the Daily News. What is this a picture of? It was black and white, but nothing else. No people and no houses anywhere. My mother came and took a look above my shoulder. It's about the Jews, she said. The Jews? It's not. It's more about those Nazis, Daddy interjected. No, Granville, no, it's about the Jews. In the war going on, my mother amplified, the German soldiers take away the Jewish families and they make them march through snow until they die. What kind of an ignorant woman are you? Daddy shouted out. It's not the snow, it's Nazi camps, the concentration camps. The camps? I asked them eagerly. The Nazis? I was quite confused. But in this picture, Daddy, I can't see nobody. Anybody, he corrected me. You can't see anybody. Yes, but what, I persevered, what is this a picture of? That's the trail of blood left by the Jewish girls and women on the snow because the Germans make them march so long. Does the snow make feet bleed, Mama? Where does the bleeding come from? My mother told me I should put away the papers and not continue to upset myself about these things I could not understand. And I remember wondering if my family was a war going on, and if there would soon be blood someplace in the house, and where the blood of my family would come from. The Spanish Civil War, I think I read about that one. Joan DeFritas, two doors up, she latched onto a soldier, fat cat bulging at the belt, and he didn't look like Hollywood said he should. So I couldn't picture him defending me or anyone, but then I couldn't picture war or North Korea at that time. There was TV. There were buses down to Washington, D.C. You could go and meet your friends from everywhere. It was very exciting. The tear gas burned like crazy. The president kept lying to us. Crowd counts at the rallies, body counts on the news, ketchup on the steps of universities, blood on the bandages around the head of the Vietnamese women shot between the eyes. Big guys, aerial spray missions, little people shot at close range. Hell no, we won't go. Hell no, we won't go. Make love, kill anything that moves. Kent State, American artillery, unlimited at Jackson State. Who raised these devil children? Who invented these Americans with ponytails and afros and t-shirts and statistical arguments against the mining of the harbors of a country far away? And I remember turning from the footage of the tat-tat-tat-tat helicopters. And I wondered how democracy would travel from the graves at Kent State to the hidden trenches of Hanoi. Plump during the war on poverty, I remember making pretty good money, $6 an hour, as a city planner. And my former husband married my best friend. And I was never positive about the next month's rent. But once I left my son, sitting on his lunchbox in the early rain, waiting for a daycare pickup, and I went to redesign low-income housing for the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And 3 hours after that, I got a phone call from my neighbors that the pickup never came, that Christopher was waiting on the sidewalk in his yellow slicker on his lunchbox in the rain. I used to sometimes call the government to tell them how my parents ate real butter or stole sugar from the victory rations we received. I sometimes called the operator asking for the police to beat up my father for beating me so bad, but no one listened to a tattletale like me. I think I felt relieved because the government didn't send a rescue face or a voice to my imagination, and I hated the police. But what else could you do? Peace never meant a thing to me. I wanted everyone to mold the plastic bag for margarine, save stamps, plant carrots, and, imitating Joe Brown Bomber Lewis, fight hard, fight fair. And from the freedom days that blazed outside my mind, I fell in love. I fell in love with black men, black women, white women. And I dared myself to say, the Palestinians. And I worried about unilateral words like lesbian or nationalist. And I tried to speak Spanish when I traveled to Managua. And I dreamed about the 14th Amendment. And I defied the hatred of the hateful everywhere as best I could. I mean, I took long nightly walks to emulate the Chinese revolutionaries. And I always wore one sweater less than absolutely necessary to keep warm. And I wrote everything I knew how to write against apartheid. And I thought I was a warrior growing up. And I buried my father with all of the ceremony, all of the music I could piece together. And I lust for justice. And I make that quest arthritic, pigeon-toed, however. And I invent the mother of the courage I require not to quit. Well, that's a long poem. Let's just take 30 seconds and look at it quietly. Hey, don't be too shocked that I'm actually writing on the boards. Of course, it's taking me 2 weeks, actually. Title of this piece, isn't this great? Isn't that wonderful? It's really an amazing, amazing piece. I love it so much. Title of this piece is War and Memory. Now, what naturally goes, and we've been talking a lot as we read poetry about the conflicts, light and dark, you know, flight and heaviness, that poems often play with bilateral distinctions. What naturally goes with war?
Peace.
And peace, absolutely. When I was a little girl, I thought war and peace, pride and prejudice, you know, crime and punishment were all written by the same person. And in our culture, we often think in these sort of opposition. The obvious thing to go with war is peace, war and peace. But she doesn't write war and peace, she writes war and memory, so we've got to get at why that is. Let's start with war. What kinds of war are in this poem?
All of them, from the Second World War to Vietnam.
Yeah, Second World War to Vietnam. Well, that's not how you do Second World War, is it? No. I was like, well, I don't know. Okay, World War II. To Vietnam. Any others? And what comes in between?
Korea.
Korea.
Well, she's got the Spanish Civil War, which we'll get into a second.
Civil War, Korean War, issues of
war and poverty.
Okay, that's a different kind of war. So this just, and then she's got the war on poverty. What is the war on poverty for our junior members who were born like 5 years ago? Way back when. The war on poverty was what? Programs, the great cities, what were some of his famous
great society?
Great Society, that's what it was, Great Society. There was a time, this may shock the junior members of our group here, but there was a time, I know, you're all thinking like, wait, we're not that little. There was a time when Americans really thought that poverty could be ended, right? It could be beat. We could fix it. That we could fix that problem. How far we've gotten from that in the last 30 years is really astonishing. But the war on poverty took a lot of federal funds into the cities and into the countryside. Okay, what other kinds of war are in this?
Family
war, family conflict. Okay, and who is that? Who's fighting?
Father and mother.
Mom, Dad, don't fight.
And her.
Dad and she, right? The narrator, the protagonist, the I.
The Palestinian War.
Hmm?
The Palestinian.
No, we've got, right? We've got she dares to say a Palestinian.
President Menagos, and that would be.
Good, excellent. Right. Right, if only to stop here. Right.
Lesbian.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know
where. Now, does that fit into war? There's this moment where her best friend marries her husband.
Yes.
Well, there's a little conflict there, I would think. So this is her family, her original family, and then also her friends and lovers. Husband, her own marriage falls apart. Okay, now, how strange is it to be putting marriage under the title of war when we're starting with World War II, right? Her marriage falls apart when there's World War II. I'm sorry, you know, these things do not balance out, right? If I could have stopped World War II, forgive me, Luther, by having my marriage fall apart, you know, I just would have considered it a small thing. Or World War II big, which is impossible, so World War II big, personal marriage small, right? Two little people. It's Casablanca.
Oh, it's hard to see, you know, it's easy to see that the lives of two little people, they're not a hill of beans, right? In the face of war.
And yet here it is on the list. Her marriage and her very small family group. Now I want to ask you, what does she see about World War II? What is it that we find out about World War II? From this poem. Jews. Jews. What else?
Separation.
Yeah.
What she hears, what she really hears when she's told about it is men abusing women.
How so?
Well, because the German soldiers are making the Jewish women and girls march across the snow until they bleed. So she sees it at a pretty personal level, not on a global level.
And she wonders what's going to happen to her family.
Yeah.
Girls.
Right. It's Nazi soldiers versus women and girls is how she constructs the war in her childhood imagination. What are the women and girls associated with? This is blood, right? The blood of the girls. Where are these girls bleeding from, do you think? Could it be something reproductive?
She's talking about feet bleed, but I don't. But I think that is what I thought.
What did you think?
I thought of menstrual blood.
Menstrual blood, or maybe after birth of some kind.
Well, I thought of maybe being raped.
Maybe being raped. Yeah. Right here in this construction, she's talking about how the absolute most personal part of identity is swept up in this national conflict, right? What is war about? It's about Neville Chamberlain, you know, standing in front of a microphone, selling sold out Czechoslovakia. or the Sudeten Land. It's about, you know, big guys going places and signing treaties. You know, for her, war is about these women walking in the snow and bleeding in the face of Nazi oppression, right? War is just the most intimate, personal kind of suffering you can possibly have. And the particular cost that women pay during war is something that I think has become increasingly visible. I think, in a sick kind of way, people almost celebrate it. You know, it's like part of the story that the news is very interested in. Anyway, here's World War II. How different is World War II from the rest of these wars in her poem?
She's a child. Doesn't seem to understand.
That's right. She's a child when she hears about this and is sort of on the, and doesn't seem to understand it good. And for these other wars?
Well, Vietnam is much more personal to her because she talks about the things happening in this country.
That's right. What is Vietnam all about for her? The president lying. What else?
Kent State.
What happens at Kent State?
I thought so.
You really need to know the
student soldiers.
What's the name of the National Guard? Opened fire on American students and killed four at Kent State on the steps of Kent State University. There might have been the protesters. It was one guy wasn't even involved in the protest. The people who were killed were 200 yards away from the soldiers. 200 yards, mm-hmm. Difficult feels bad. And they were fired upon killed. Jackson State, same situation. Those were African American students. So I think about the same number killed, although I'm not really sure. Might have been more even. And not very long after that. A situation where the government is firing on the youth of its own country. How what's her relationship here in Vietnam to the war? Here we've decided she's a girl, she doesn't quite understand, she's kind of apart. What about Vietnam?
Something.
What is she doing?
Television, because she hears the rat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah.
She calls it all attention to the women being shot in. She's got that male-female thing again, yeah. Since it's big guys.
Big guys,
you know.
That's right. Big guys and the president line. So she's still in opposition. There's still a difference between the power structure and her. She's grown, though, and she's got a voice of resistance now, right? She's got some strategies of resistance. She's saying, hell no, we won't go. And notice how these things go together, the make love and the hell no, we won't go, sort of the diptych of Vietnam protest.
Yeah. Interesting thing about that is that in the earlier portion of it, she doesn't have any support outside her family at all. She's running through the streets and there's no evidence at all that anybody's helping her with her father running after her. And here she says, you could go and meet your friends from everywhere.
That's
it's
right.
Very exciting. So she begins to connect
That's
to
right.
a network of other people.
Right, there's clouds at the rally. That's really good. I wanted to also mention, when you read about the her parents' reaction to the Jews, does it change your idea of the situation at all?
Well, her father identifies it as the aggressors, and her mother identifies it as the victim.
Right.
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 And her mother says not to trouble herself about it. It's almost as if that's the her mother's way of coping with either situation, is just not to bother yourself about it.
So in a way, the way they read World War II tells you a lot about how they have structured their own relationship. Does it give you any good news? Her father, at least, is not cheering on the Nazis. Seriously, to me this is a good sign. He is not saying bad things about the Jews. In our culture, we have a divide that is often
exploited
between African Americans and Jewish people. And you know, it's a divide that should not be there by any historical reason. And he does not identify himself in opposition to the Jews at all. So to me, this is something that is setting up the elegiac conclusion where she buries her father with ceremony and singing.
And it also talks about how her father's reading and he's interested in things outside the house.
Yes.
And he corrects her English. So he's obviously somewhat educated and gave her some appreciation of things beyond the house.
Yes, absolutely, which is not a bad thing. And I hadn't really seen until this reading how no, Granville, no means both you're interpreting the world, World War II incorrectly, and you're fighting unjustly against me, right? And no, Daddy, no, it's repeated again and again. All right, so the Vietnam War, and then the war on poverty is even a little bit, seems like a little bit more positive. She's earning money being a city planner, right? And this is all good. Why is this story about her little boy sitting on the curb there? Why is that included? Yeah.
I thought it was about how she's...
Well, she's being consistent to her calling, which is working for the this housing and making a commitment. The part of the world that's to be consistent or committed to her child is not. Is that right? I kind of saw that as a...
Well, I mean, that she's part of the war on poverty.
Yes, how so?
Well, they instituted daycare, so mothers can work without worrying about their children.
It's really when it all started to happen.
I read something, too, just about... I mean, there seems to be this anger directed at her dad or her parents for sort of not always coming through, not always being there, and somehow... just a little tinge of reality that she was to blame for this situation too, that she didn't always come through for her kids, that maybe, I don't know, it softened me to her parents a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's very generous of you. That's very good. Yeah, I hear that too. And it is it's a story to twist the heart of anyone who's had any kind of daycare, which would be everybody in the world. So
but she says it very matter-of-factly, like this is just reality.
Yeah.
And then those parts afterwards where she talks about her kind of love-hate relationship with the establishment, she sees that sometimes the neglect is preferable to the attention. So she's kind of ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a real worthy for a single mother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Really a real thing.
She's fighting the war on poverty, and meanwhile, she doesn't know where her own rent is coming from. And also this sense that war has a cost to women, in particular, that might not be figured in our body counts, right, is also present in this part of the story.
And yet the neighbors call.
That's right.
So she's getting support.
That's also there. That's very good. And the boy did the right thing, which is also kind of...
You know,
it was.
Yeah.
He's returned to her, has a sort of happy ending. Poor little Wade. Immediately after she tells us this story of her son, which I very much like Anne-Marie's idea that she's kind of circling back to her own childhood and relationships of childhood, maybe trying to be a new kind of parent, but still having some of the same dynamics. Immediately after she tells the story of her son in the rain, she goes back to talking about what she used to do as a child. And it's a funny story, I think, although tragic also. She used to call the police. She used to call the government and tell them that her parents were eating, you know, real butter. And she wanted everyone to fight fair. Why does she go back there? Why isn't this stuff back at the beginning of the story? Why is it even included?
I think she's kind of telling us about herself and her what she brought to the table in terms of her way of looking at the fairness and justice in life and how extreme it was that she didn't tell her parents.
Yeah. Right. She had a real black and white image of the world, just like that black and white picture. That's good. What do you learn about her from this story, aside from that she has this clear sense of justice? Fight hard, fight fair.
She had courage.
She had a lot of courage.
That's right.
I think it's interesting that she felt relieved that they didn't come, though. It's like she had this justice, and yet she had this sort of indebtedness to, I don't know, just that she wanted to be just, but she didn't really want the consequences of what might happen.
Yeah.
And when she says peace never meant a thing to me, it's almost like she enjoyed the conflict too. She enjoyed the turmoil or her ability to put herself forward as having a sense of what was right.
Mm-hmm. She enjoyed the drama, you think?
Yeah.
I wonder.
I just think it means justice meant a lot more.
Peace, no, that's good. Peace didn't mean anything because she's worried about right and wrong. She's worried about justice. But then why does she not want the police to come? Why does she hate the police if she's worried about justice?
Culture.
Right?
You want the police. There's an awful lot of I at the end here.
Yes, totally. Good eyes.
I was just going to ask I'm going on. Maybe I should. I'm just going
to. Let's just stay here for another second. So hang on to that thought if you can. Always a problem for me, but really try concentrate.
Well,
is this, let's go ahead. Yeah.
This is not a period in which you were going to be treated fairly, but at least if you were African American anyway.
Right.
So.
Yes. Yes.
When is that period?
Yeah. When is that period in the world to come?
Yeah. I often ask my all white students. They're almost always white. Is the policeman your friend? Do you feel that if you're in trouble, you look to a policeman for help? And if you do, that's then you're middle class, right? That's middle class privilege, assuming that the police are going to help you out. That's middle class privilege, because it's hard to identify that. And if instead you think, yeah, the police can help me, but they could choose in a minute to turn against me, that's an experience very, very common to people, both of lower class backgrounds and of racially other than white backgrounds. So if you're wondering if you're middle class, like me, that's kind of a litmus test.
We live in Chicago, and I cannot, in the Chicago area, and I cannot convince our youngest child that the police are friendly.
Yeah.
They are enemies,
yeah.
And he's four.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's
in the Chicago area, they are oftentimes.
Yeah. They have a lot of power. Yeah. We had African-American friends who used to walk across the University of Chicago campus, which is a kind of island, racial island. We need to quit racing. Thank you, Luther. And be stopped by the security guards just routinely. They had to keep their IDs up so they could walk across the campus where they attended school. It's not an unusual situation. So yes, she dreams of justice. She longs for it. She's not in a world where the officials will back up justice, is she? She's not in that kind of world. She's in a world where they don't take her side, even though she sees black and white what's right.
And she's very idealistic. She
yeah.
somehow, in spite
yes.
of all the evidence,
yes.
believes that they will,
yes.
that they could.
And this is something I read here. This young girl has a strategy of resistance. She has an idea of right and wrong, and not only does she have that, which a lot of us have, she's got ideas about how to enforce it, right? They don't work. But she's trying, and she picks herself up. And immediately after she tells you this funny story about how she used to try and rat on her own parents, kind of funny, sad, and how peace doesn't mean anything to her because she's focused on justice, immediately after she tells you this, now you hear all her other strategies of resistance. She tries to speak Spanish when she goes to Managua, and she worries about labels that we put on people like lesbian, and now I'm just thinking about how I told you that she was a lesbian poet, and here in her poem she's saying she fell in love with everybody. I'm thinking that was a bit reductive, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's worried about labels the way we should all worry about labels. She's dreaming, that's a strategy that she has. She is defying the hatred. She's writing. She's taking long walks. She is bringing every weapon in her arsenal to bear on her existence in the late 20th century and what she sees around her. So she's a little girl with strategies. She's a grown woman with strategies. She still ends up with her boy out on the sidewalk, and they don't always work, but she keeps going, and this I starts to come through, right? And this is how she makes her mark in the world. By seeing the connections, and by insisting upon them, and by putting herself forward again and again and again, and kind of constructing herself as she identifies her resistance to all this stuff that's on war, right?
It's a very personal fight.
Very personal and very political at the same time, right? There's no kind of lefty thing that she's not engaged in here. And finally, what she invents is the mother of the courage she requires not to quit. And here I have to say, what does memory then do for you? What is memory? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Like we've got all this war, personal, political, all interwoven. What's the memory for?
Her mother just saying, what she said, her mother continuing
yeah.
with this abusive
yeah.
man and just put that away, don't think about that, now just keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Would that be inventing the mother of courage, you think?
Okay.
Does her mother seem courageous?
No, it's like she needed to, like Mom and I always talk about the wise mom who just comes into your arms and kind of has all that wisdom. And it's like she needed to invent somebody to be that for her, the mother of that courage. She needed someone to teach her what that was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't there for her. And so she had to invent it for herself.
She had to put it together for herself. That's her final strategy of resistance, is inventing her own mother. But not denying her real mother, right?
When her memory
kept going.
Yeah. And in her poem, the memory is held up, right? She's telling these stories. She's keeping them alive. Memory is part of her resistance, finally, and part of her way of understanding. So she invents something to keep going, but it's not made out of whole cloth. It's made out of the real parts of her past, I think.
I find it interesting that she mentions apartheid, but not the war for equality in the United States.
Yeah, the Civil War, you mean? Or the Civil Rights Movement?
The Civil Rights Movement.
What is the 14th Amendment?
I think it's the women's. It's the ERA.
Isn't it the 14th Amendment? Isn't the 14th Amendment the one that gave slaves?
No.
Which one is the one that freed the slaves? Isn't that 14th?
I don't think so.
The 15th.
It might be the women's vote, but I thought that was the 20th.
Is that, do you know?
Giving 18, women suffrage?
18th
area. I think it's free of the slaves. Yeah. I think the 14th
Amendment. So then that would be something to do with it.
Okay, well, I need to go because I promised my son I'd come for the singing of Shalom to the little kids who are leaving Narnia today. I want you to think, as you carry this poem with you into the day, about peace never meant a thing to me. It is set off by itself in the poem as a single line. Mm-hmm. And I want you to think about what peace might have meant, right? What do we arrive at the end at some... Can you think about both peace and justice at the same time? Can you arrive at peace through thinking about justice? It's put in the past tense, right? Peace never meant a thing to her. Does peace now mean something to her, having gone through this? Mm-hmm. This life process toward envisioning and inventing and strategizing about resistance. Think about that. And for your pleasure, here are some wonderful poems on the back, including this poem by Lucille Clifton. There's a girl inside, which is a really terrific poem. So please read and enjoy. And really, thank you very much for your conversation this week. It has been a great pleasure for me.
Thank you.